Welcome everyone to Edge Talk Radio. I am Angela Zabel, that's me, and I am here today with Christopher Noel. He is an author and from Vermont, and we are going to begin diving in deep, so hold on to your bootstraps with this one. So who am I? I am connected to spirit. I've been working with the team in the non-physical my entire life, sharing messages from a multitude of realms with people. I am a teacher, coach, and a medium, radio show host, which is why I'm here, writer, retreat host, gallery reader, speaker. I do online and private group sessions, offering guidance, mediumship, intuition, speaking engagements, and sharing knowledge with others, working with people throughout the world. And today we are on Edge Talk Radio. And the Edge Talk Radio is the Edge Magazine is the leading events and social media resource dedicated to all aspects of holistic living, health and wellness, and the mysteries beyond, sharing information, wisdom, resources, committed to promoting businesses, organizations, and individuals who support our collective journey to wholeness and balance. You can find out more about Edge Magazine at edgemagazine.net. If you're looking for information on me, it's angelazabel.com, and I'm on all the social media aspects, so just go on and check it out. And today, I am going to be working with Christopher Noel, and he holds a master's degree in philosophy from Yale and an MFA from Vermont College of Fine Arts, where he taught for 20 years. He has dedicated the past 14 years to learning about the Sasquatch series. He's an author of several books on the subject, including most recently, There Is No Veil, and we're going to be getting into that one a little bit later. The Sasquatch Savant Theory, Next of Kin, Next Door, How to Find Sasquatch, A Stone's Throw Away, The Mind of Sasquatch, and The Secret to Their Success, and A Field Guide to Sasquatch Structures. Noel lives in Vermont's Northeast Kingdom, and he has Our Life with Bigfoot, Knowing Our Nested Kid at Habituation Sites. So he also has done Sasquatch and Autism, Sasquatch Rising, The Dead Giants Tell No Tales, DNA Breakthroughs and Backyard Visits, Reveal the Greatest Story of Our Time. He's also done Mind Speak, Tapping with Sasquatch and Science, and The Electric Sasquatch, How a Natural Force May Explain Supernatural Powers, and There Is No Veil, A Play at the Vast Here and Now. And she also has the nonfiction or the fiction of The Girl Who Spoke with Giants as a novel. And you can find him on his social media aspect. The biggest places to go on his Facebook page is christopher.noel.980, and the links will be down below. You can also find his books on Amazon, and that link will also be below. So make sure to check out that information on Christopher, because there's a lot of great information there. And I got to meet Christopher in person not that long ago. And after meeting him, I knew I had to have him on today. So Christopher, how did you start on this whole journey of starting with Sasquatch?
Well, thank you so much, my friend. What a lovely introduction. I'm humbled and delighted to be here. Well, when I was about 11 years old, and this is a common first kind of inspiration for people, is I saw the Patterson film, the famous Patterson film, shot in Northern California in 1967. And
of you who don't know the Patterson film, can you talk about what that is?
Yeah, it's a 58-second film shot by Roger Patterson. He and his friend Bob Gimlin were riding horses in Northern California in a place called Bluff Creek, and they had been looking for Sasquatch, and they looked for 3 weeks, and I think they were close to giving up for that expedition, but they'd been riding their horses around for 3 weeks, finding footprints, large five-toed footprints, and then one fateful afternoon, October 20th, they rounded a bend in a valley that was had experienced a 500-year flood. So there's all this driftwood and debris and crazy mud and silt everywhere. And the horses reared up, because there, crouched beside the river, the little brook, it's not really a river, a little brook, was this large, hairy creature. And she turned around and looked at them, stood up, and then made her way off at an angle toward the forest, but she had to cross a wide mud flat on the way to the forest. So they were able, Roger Patterson was able to dismount. The horse fell back on his leg. It was so freaked out. He managed to wriggle out of that and get his 16mm camera out of the saddlebag and start it. It gets cranked up. So I guess it was fully cranked. So then he just press a button and it starts right up. And he took the iconic 58 seconds of footage of this upright walking female individual walking away and swinging her arms. You can tell she's a female because she has breasts, and she swings her arms, and she, at one point, she looks back, and that's the famous frame number 352 that we've all seen many times, where she turns back to look, make sure that they're not following her, just check them out, and she goes and she disappears off into the forest, off into the mists of legend. And so when I saw that as an 11-year-old, I think it was kind of like one of those little features before a full feature-length movie, before a regular movie.
Right.
My imagination was captured, and I thought, that's not a person in a suit. Even though a lot of people think it is, I could just tell. I could just, maybe I wanted to be able to tell, because it wasn't until many years later that film analysis was able to enhance the details in the figure and find all sorts of muscle groups moving underneath the fur, and find that her limb proportions, her legs to her arms to her torso, are very different from human proportions. Mm-hmm. And her gait, the way she walked, her biomechanics is also different from humans. They will walk with their feet landing right in front of each other as they go. So it looks like a tightrope walk, whereas we have a staggered set of footprints. So that was my introduction to it. And that would have been 1971 or so. And it wasn't until 2005 that I stumbled upon the fact that there were these expeditions that people were taking through the BFRO, the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, and that you could sign up and actually go. And one was scheduled only an hour and a half from where I live in Northern Vermont. So I signed up, I went, and my life changed forever. Not that I had any direct experience with Sasquatch at the time, but what it did for me, this three-day expedition, was to expose me to people who were serious about the subject, who knew a lot more than I did about it, and whose imaginations had likewise been captured years earlier. And the veteran researchers had been able to devise a sort of a systematic method of having interactions with them, which meant going to out at night in spots that have a history of sightings over the years, and making overtures, knocking on trees and going whoop and such, and mostly just sitting quietly and being receptive and emanating goodwill. And you'll sometimes hear them knocking back to you or knocking to one another. And nothing else in nature besides human beings will like knock against a tree. Woodpeckers don't do that. They don't do one loud knock. They're not that loud anyway. So you know that either you're being tricked by a human being at 2:30 in the morning in the middle of the forest with no light, with no flashlight, or it's a Sasquatch.
I mean, one of the things I think I was really drawn to you is you're really about documenting what you're experiencing, documenting what's out there. And I think that's something that I think was really needed. And I'm guessing they were documenting some things there too, but I think you just knowing you a little bit is your attention to detail and wanting to make sure you have all of the details down is that documentation. And I'm going to do a little, let people in a little bit. I did hear some of the things that Christopher shared with me with the whooping and the knocking, and it is absolutely amazing. So, and is some of that up on YouTube now?
Yeah, you're referring to 3 nights ago, I was out at my usual spot and I went, and 6 seconds later, I can even play it if it'll come through. It's unlisted on YouTube just to share with friends because it's all going to go into a documentary. So I don't want to make everything public before that.
Right.
I made that call, and then 6 seconds later, from down by the river where they tend to hang out, I hear something very similar calling back. And it's nothing that could be anything but a Sasquatch, because it also knocked softly knocked on some wood. It goes, and it called back. If mine was woo, whoop, it was woo, whoop. So it wasn't exactly the same, but it pretty clearly was a mimicry. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, there's an old saying in field research that if it's not documented, it didn't happen, which of course is an overstatement, because it does happen. And lots of times when people don't bring cameras and out with them, they get more activity because, you know, they're not trying too hard. They're not trying to sort of like capture Sasquatch in ways that Sasquatch doesn't want to be captured. But on the other hand, I do like to film. I have a night vision scope, which is just passive. It doesn't send out any infrared beam or anything. It just takes the available light from the moon and the stars and magnifies it within the tube. I have that duct tape to my normal video camera, so that I can, you know, especially when it's not too overcast, I can see pretty well through that. And anyway, I'm getting way, way ahead of the story. Just to circle back briefly.
We're just having fun.
No, I know. I just I'll fill in, connect the dots a little. So after going on a whole bunch of expeditions with the BFRO and learning a lot from veterans and hearing occasional sounds from Sasquatch, and just hearing so many stories of encounters, I was really hooked. Completely hooked. And I just kind of like made it a priority and took a vow of poverty, because, you know, I was flying all over the country doing this instead of making money. But then as the internet matured, I was able to sort of network with people who were living in spots where they had Sasquatch kind of regularly paying visits and doing little things to make their presence known, like tapping on the windows or throwing pebbles up on the roof, or slapping the side of the house at 3 a.m.
That'll wake you up.
freaking everybody out. And sometimes like growling when someone would go to walk the dog in the house. the dogs would have no, they would have none of it. They would just slink back toward the house.
I think I would too.
I know. So there's these places that are sort of loosely known as habituation sites, in the tradition of Jane Goodall or Diane Fossey, who habituated their primate groups to study them. And habituation just means to familiarize yourself with each other, so that the level of instinctive fear and otherness kind of erodes over time. So I got to know online various people who had come to an acquaintance with the habits and the routines of their local Sasquatch group, and would audio record them, and sometimes get little snippets of video and still images. And so I came to realize that it was a better, more efficient, and a richer route to getting to know these this kindred species who are another kind of people, wild people. The better route was to learn from habituation sites rather than just to take a stab in the dark by going out in a group of people and knocking on trees, which can work, but it's much less, you know, the best you're going to get is a knock back or a vocalization. And it's thrilling to get that, but you're not going to learn much more than you did the first time you heard it, you know. Whereas at habituation sites, lots of times people will trade objects with Sasquatch. Sasquatch will bring from somewhere else, some other house, they'll bring an object that looks very much like the ones that you have on your porch, and they'll put it right next to that to show that they have a very associative mind, and they like objects. They speak to us often through things that they arrange and rearrange, and they'll take our things and rearrange them in sort of humorous and playful ways. That was, being in touch with these people was what allowed me to put together my first book, Our Life with Bigfoot, which has six different testimonials from families and individuals who live at these habituation sites. So that's a nutshell of my trajectory in studying Sasquatch. Oh, and then I found out that I didn't have to go all over. Not only did I not have to go to expeditions, I didn't have to rely on habituation sites all over North America, because Sasquatch lived right here in my backyard. And I was able to capitalize on that fact. And it turns out one of the main paradigm shifts that's happened in Sasquatch research over the past few years is that we don't have to think of them as just living in the wilderness, far from human beings, in order to be safe and insulated from us. Many of them do live in the wilderness, but many of them also live right next to our settlements, our civilization. I think they're as drawn to us through kinship as we are to them. So I managed to find some spots right here in northern Vermont, several different spots where I could reliably have interactions with them. One was a ravine just 2 miles from my house where I had pine cones thrown at me and wood on wood drumming sounds from like a couple hundred feet away every single morning when I would go in. It's like drum riffs. And I have a video all about the ravine. It's called Sasquatch Up Close and Personal, like 2 years of learning in the ravine. And that's on my YouTube channel, which is called Impossible Visits, that channel.
So your YouTube channel is called Impossible Visits?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I missed that.
Well, that's okay. Now I get to fill in some stuff.
That's true. Role.
Yeah. So to this day, I continue to do local Sasquatch research, and I don't have to go all over heck and creation anymore. They're right here. In fact, they're everywhere. All you listeners out there or viewers, if you have undeveloped forest near you, even little micro forests, if you find interesting stick and tree structures that don't quite look like they'd be fun for kids to make or grown-ups to make, you know, our species to make, if they look strange but definitely intentionally assembled, just leave an audio recorder out there near these structures for several nights running, and then listen to it in real time, because you can't just look at the spectrogram, because lots of the sounds that they make don't register. They're subtle but obvious. Like they'll make a Kong cluck, or they'll tap on trees in a way in the middle of the night when woodpeckers don't, and it's obvious that it's not a woodpecker, because it just doesn't sound like that rhythm. It'll be like, well, that sounds like a woodpecker. Never mind. I can't think. Well, maybe it's all been woodpeckers. Oh, no.
I haven't seen too many woodpeckers pecking at night.
pecking at night. No.
Yeah, not too many pecking at night.
No, but anyway, if you hear, especially wood knocks, loud, single, double, triple wood knocks, like you know it's not a woodpecker if it's 3 a.m. And so if you hear that, or if you hear trees being pushed over on a still night, completely still night, and you hear a violent tree push, which is quite common with them, they like to do that. Or if you hear vocalizations like whoop, or strange whistle that you can't connect to any known bird. I for some reason in my old age here have lost my ability to whistle, but one that they make around here is just, it sounds, I call it the toothy whistle because it's more toothy than what I just did. And it's just a straight whistle. And some people have Sasquatch, local Sasquatch that go up at the end. Could you hear that?
I could hear it a little bit, yeah, with it going in and then going up. Yep.
Okay.
So how did you actually like find out they're in your backyard? I mean, because yeah, you're there. So what did you do? Like just go wandering around and
Well, yeah, the various places that I found them, it had different sort of a genesis. Like with the ravine, I heard of a friend of mine told me that he had heard, it was like third hand, he had heard about somebody who saw one crossing the road right next to that ravine. So I went to check out the ravine, which is right close to houses, but I never saw anybody in there. It's kind of hard to get into and steep, you know, and I went in there and I right away found obvious stick and tree structures. They make a whole bunch of different kinds of structures and you get to know them over time. And I put them in my field guide to Sasquatch structures. They'll make teepee structures, which is something that people like to make too. They'll make big pinwheel structures with like 5 or 6 elements, like staves, whatever you call them. Okay. They'll stuff lots of little branches into the crooks of trees, stuff them in there. They like to wedge things and stuff things. They'll put they'll take whole trees and put them up inside another tree.
Oh, like, interesting.
They'll take a littler tree and put it up inside of a big tree, and you know that there's no way that a windstorm. because that's the isolated thing. It's not part of some destruction that could come from a kind of little cyclone weather event.
Yeah.
So there's many, many kinds. They'll stick them in the ground. If you find one branch or tree limb stuck 6 inches in the ground and going straight up, that could just be random. But if you find 5 of them within 25 feet, you know that that's pretty intentional.
Yeah.
So lots of them you get to know. So that was how I found that one in the ravine. And then I started recording all night long and getting obvious Sasquatch telltale audio signals. And then one morning I went in there to pick up my recorder extra early, like 7 a.m. And I started hearing them knocking in the broad daylight. I thought it was just a nighttime thing. And then I knocked and they knocked back. And that was the start of a whole series of mornings that I would go and get reliable, those drumming sounds I mentioned, from right on the other side of a screen of thick leaves. It was a screen of trees, of leaves.
Wow.
And, you know, I never went rushing in there because I wanted to establish a trusting relationship. He was trusting me enough to make his presence heard. And anyway, so then another place I lived, which was 12 miles from the ravine where I live now, my daughter would go walking in this little micro forest near us, and she called it her territory. And she went there and she would watch the deer and stuff. And then one day I said, can I go with you to your territory? And she regretted that because she let me go in there. And my attention was completely glued to all these structures that I saw. And sure enough, when I put a recorder in there, the structures were correlated with Sasquatch sounds. And you know, you figure, what are the chances that Sasquatch are in there, but they're not the ones who made the structures? Because you know that all higher primates manipulate their environment, you know, chimpanzees and bonobos and orangutans and gorillas and us, we all manipulate our environment. And Sasquatch is the material of their lives are sticks and trees and limbs and leaves and stones. And so, you know, they have this huge brain and big hands and plenty of muscles, so, and plenty of time on their hands. So it would be shocking if they didn't do things with their the elements of their environment.
Was that also part of like your journey too, was when you started on here, was investigating more on primates, how they moved, kind of understanding how they operated and kind of bringing that correlation in with the Sasquatch?
Yeah, there's a lot of overlap. And then you watch documentaries on primates and you see them knocking on trees and pushing trees over as sort of intimidation, and marking their trails, which Sasquatch also do, and making nests, which Sasquatch also do. But Sasquatch are a whole lot more like us than like a gorilla or a chimpanzee, in that they'll make much more intricate sort of sculptures out of trees and branches than any other primate will do. Very, very intelligent, sophisticated structures sometimes. Sometimes very simple ones, sometimes very, very elaborate weaving and things that you can't even figure out how they put together. They're sort of geniuses when it comes to visual intelligence and building these pieces, these works of art, really. And that's the difference. Like chimpanzees and gorillas will make nests to sleep in, but they don't seem to have aesthetic expressions like Sasquatch does. And then you have the habituation sites where Sasquatch demonstrates its attention to detail in terms of, like, this woman in Ohio, Snow White Bigfoot is her channel name. She, for years now, has been having this ongoing move-by-move game with her local Sasquatch group. And for instance, she one time put two big gourds on the railing on her porch, and the next morning they were switched. It was switched, and she talk about documentation. She diligently documents every single step of the game back and forth, and so she had pictures. There's pictures of everything before and after. And she'll have dice with the three dice or three die flush together with the sixes on top, and then the next morning they'll be equally perfectly flush together with the ones on top. And then, you know, a crow and a raccoon is not going to do that.
No, not usually.
So Sasquatch are much, they're our closest relative by far. You know, mainstream science always says the chimpanzee is our closest relative, but they're lost in the dust of antiquity compared to Sasquatch. Sasquatch are apparently originally, according to the DNA results, they're originally 50-50, human, women, and a species of another. The father being another species, probably a primate species that hasn't yet been discovered.
Interesting.
So they were originally 50-50, but then since then they've mostly reproduced with their own kind. So it would be less obviously human than it would have been thousands and thousands of years ago when the crossbreeding happened. But they still have that human origin in them, and they're just as smart as we are, and smarter in many, many regards, you know.
So when you started doing, like, you were doing all the different structures in that, do you have pictures of some of those in that field guide also that you have?
Those are pen and ink drawings.
Okay.
But in my videos on my channel, I have multiple, too many pictures. People get bored with how much I document these structures. I find them endlessly fascinating, but people are like, more of the same structures? I say, yeah, but look, can you imagine how they made this? So yeah, there's lots of those. And I have pictures of structures in various books, but not in the field guide. That's just pen and ink drawings.
Okay. Just so people understand, so they can look, know where they want to look at, know what they want to check out, because I find it fascinating with, you know, how much is in the woods, how much is around us that we don't see. Because one of the things I like to tell people when they question, like, is there Sasquatch, is there, you know, the Bigfoot, is there this, is you know, is there bears? Are there badgers? Are there different things? Like for us, there's badgers here, there's bears here, but how many in our area have actually seen them? Very, 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 very
few. I've seen five bears and like three moose in what is it now? 50 years of living in Vermont. And there's tons of them around here.
And they're there. And those are big animals. Those are not small.
Exactly. No. Exactly. You think you'd see them all the time, but and they are equipped with the human intelligence and the sort of basic imperative not to be seen. Every now and then you catch them by surprise, like in the Patterson film situation, or, you know, there's tons of stories of people hiking and they come around a bend and there's one standing there, and it's as shocked to see them as we are to see them. And but you know, they weren't paying attention. Like 99.9999% of the time, they are much more aware of us than we ever are of them. And it's the rarest of moments when, you know, they slip up. But they quickly remedy that by simply walking away. Go ahead.
So that's one of the things too, as you had mentioned, audio and video. And so you can capture a lot more on audio, and there is a lot more on audio out there than there is on video. Have you ever seen or heard of like things happening with cameras themselves or video equipment where they stop working just before or something like that?
Yeah, and this kind of crosses over into the spiritual, into spirit, because just like with spiritual experiences, there's this famous phenomenon that happens with Sasquatch field research, which is that the batteries will get drained, or the camera will suddenly be disrupted or frozen. And then, you know, when you're out of the area, the camera works fine for the next 5 years, you know, and it never messed up before that. And Sasquatch seem able to either send from their bodies or allow nature to intensify the electromagnetic energy in the air. And that is not good for electronics.
No.
We call it the Bigfoot curse. Lots of times we'll have all these video files that successfully were stored in the memory of the camera. And then we'll have two corrupt files, which of course were the time when you most wanted to see what you got on the camera. And that happens with ghost hunters too.
Absolutely. That's something it's very common for a lot of, that's why people are like, oh, it wasn't on camera. It's like, well, because a lot of times they're messing with the electronics, messing with the camera. So you can't get it on there.
They have the ability to do it. I know. I don't know what it is. I mean, it might just come down to consciousness. I think that Sasquatch have a expansive and powerful psychic ability / just expansive consciousness more than most people do. And I think that, and like spirit consciousness, they can influence the physical world. And so it makes sense that as a defense mechanism over the eons, when it was a matter of survival of their species, not to be dominated and killed and trapped and sent on reservations by our species, they would develop this defense mechanism that originally was just to disable us. Like people talk about getting zapped out when they're near Sasquatch. So have an overwhelming feeling of disorientation or dread or nausea or just absolute feeling like they're going to die or that they need to leave immediately. And that's sort of this, I think, the same sort of energy that can also affect the cameras. I think it's electromagnetic. And I don't know how they do it. But I don't know how spirit manipulates electromagnetism either.
Yeah, I'm not sure how they do it, but I know they do it. I've had where they were taking pictures. I was getting professional pictures done for some new things, and they stopped all the professional photographers, stopped his camera, stopped all his equipment, drained everything to zero. And I was laughing. I'm like, I think it's me. He's like, no, I've got it. I'm like, I think it's me.
So I think it's me.
I walked away. And then when I walked further away, I'm like, did they go on now? He goes, yep, everything's back up. And then I walked closer and everything everything went dead again.
Oh my goodness. Well, it's you. It's all you. It's not spirit. It's just you.
But they also want to show people they're able to manipulate that stuff. Because right. then I asked them, like, okay, we got to get pictures taken. Let's make it work. So then they turned everything back on. But sometimes it's that ability that they can do it to show us they're around. So right. some of that is to show us they are there. And that is the evidence, is having the cameras do go off, that everything does get corrupted. That is part of the evidence too. So I think that's something big that's right there in front of us too.
Yeah, and with Sasquatch, I think they want to show who's boss, who's in control. They wouldn't have been able to accomplish this survival all these eons without even being believed in by most people, even though they're just 100 yards away much of the time, if it weren't for the fact that they're in control. And so that's the bottom line, is that they control the environment. They control knowing space and terrain more than we ever can. And they must be a photographic memory, because whenever people try to put up game cameras, you know, it's just like if somebody took a number two in the middle of your living room, instantly they just know. They memorize every square inch of there. So they just look around and, oh, what's that? Oh, yeah. Even if you try to hide it, obvious to them. And they will sometimes, people will get their game cameras back, and they'll see a series of pictures that were triggered by like a branch waving in front of the lens. Or they'll have the camera, it was strapped to a tree, and then it'll have been dragged around to the back of the tree. So they have a bunch of pictures of just the rest of the tree instead of what you wanted to get. So they will mess. They, you know, they don't take that lightly, getting photographed. And so, you know, if I were really pure of heart, I wouldn't try to photograph them, because they obviously don't want to be.
Right.
But a couple of years ago, I was walking out to the same spot that the other night I got that mimic response, and I managed to have a 7 foot. Not 7 foot tall, but a 7 foot away encounter with a young Sasquatch that climbed up an apple tree. And you can see that at the end of my documentary, How to See a Sasquatch, on YouTube. And that was thrilling. It was midnight. And although there was a full moon, this was happening underneath the canopy of this apple tree. So it's definitely compromised. And it's not sharp and clear, but I think if people know what they're looking at, I mean, I think if people really study the footage with an open mind, they'll see that the figure cannot be other than a primate. And it knocked on the tree before I even got there. I heard a quiet little knock, and it was right in the direction I was going anyway to camp out, because I used to sleep out by myself a lot in these forests, to be closer to Sasquatch. And then when I was right next to the apple tree, I heard stamping on the ground, like on the ground. So I stopped, and I, with the camera rolling, and I said hello, and there's this little black fuzzy thing in there, and I filmed it, and it turned around and climbed up the apple tree, and then did stuff up in the apple tree for the next 11 minutes while I was right there. But it was a lot of intervening branches and leaves, so you know, that's, you never get them in the open, hardly ever. But this was a privilege, and I'm very grateful for it. I at one point I got it reaching a long arm out and then going, and that's in the footage. It was eating something, and it popped it in his mouth.
And this one is on your YouTube channel also?
Yeah, that's in the documentary I mentioned, How to See a Sasquatch.
How to See a Sasquatch, nice. Yeah. So people are definitely going to have to go check out some more of this stuff with Christopher, because there's a lot of great information on there.
You're just going to have to.
And then, so something where, so for those of you who don't know, I've got a team on the other side and they've been kind of, they're niggling a question at me.
Oh, good, good. I like their question.
And I don't know if you'll know this or not, but do you have any idea, are primates, are they colorblind? Do they have a colorblind aspect to them or not? Is that anything you know, or maybe they're just kind of bringing it up to kind of look, because a lot of times years ago, they would actually use people who were colorblind when there was wars, when there were things, because they could see in the forest and see things that others couldn't see because they were colorblind. And I'm just, they're just kind of niggling, like, did you ever check to see if anything's colorblind? If primates have, are more adapt to colorblindness.
So, I don't know when it comes to other primates, but I know that Sasquatch don't seem to be colorblind because they really prefer blue things.
Okay.
They love blue things. And many times, the woman I mentioned, Snow White Bigfoot in Ohio, on YouTube, her video diary entries, she calls them, she will find that they bring the same color to match with the same color.
Nice.
On the porch. A lot of times it's marbles. They'll put, you know, there's three blue marbles and a clear marble and a red marble, and they'll put the blue marble next to the other blue marbles, and you know, and then they'll find another red marble and put it next to the red. So we know that at least her group can see color, and I think they all can, because people report all over the world that inside Sasquatch structures they'll find blue objects, usually taken from usually human objects, like blue marbles or blue, little blue toy or something. So
that's quite interesting, because they I don't know why they kept bringing up about the color blindness and color, and if they see color. So they wanted you to discuss that part.
I think they also can see hunters in their orange, because they seem to really scatter when hunting season comes around. But I think it would be more evolutionarily advantageous to be able to see color in general, because you know, it's, you know, what helps you identify what plants you can eat. They're omnivores, and they don't seem to come around here much until late June, which is exactly when a lot of the edibles and the berries begin to come out. And there's a whole, as you I'm sure know, there's a whole range of edible plants that people in the know can make use of in nature. So they hunt deer and other game, and they also eat tons of forage plants. Yeah. So and I'm sure they know what's medicinally useful for this or that. You know, they've had so many thousands of years of culture you know, accumulated knowledge to pass on that. And I'm sure that color plays a big role in that. I'm not sure, but it just seems like it, especially knowing they can distinguish color at
awesome
this house in Ohio.
I know it's something they just wanted to bring up. So I don't know if there's somebody out there who is questioning color blindness or color, but they were wanted it brought up. So for some reason,
I'm glad. please let them ask me anything they want to.
So one of the other things is you had talked about kind of people being almost frozen or feeling different, and there's you have mind speak, tapping into Sasquatch and science. And one part in there had those who have interacted with Sasquatch have commonly reported an intimate mental contact. Descriptions of this experience cover the whole emotional range from euphoria to fascination to profound terror. And is that something, is there other aspects more of like also telepathy aspects where you feel like you're okay? I mean, you've been in the woods, you've sat out there. Most people wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
And did you feel like fearful, or were you more excited and wanting to connect? Is it more of an intention behind people, or what's your thoughts?
I am mostly, my fascination level outweighs my fear level. I've had trees pushed down 25 feet from me very loudly, and also 30 feet and close by trees. And I'm basically thrilled when that happens, because when you're out there, even though you're in their territory, because you've established that by audio recording and structure finding, 99 percent of the time, not a thing, single thing happens. So the real disappointment, the real more authentic fear, if it, you can call it that, is that you'll just come up empty and feel like a sort of a dope for spending these nights there. And, you know, it's just kind of like, feel kind of like Don Quixote, you know, thinking that the windmills are dragons, you know, when he's like, he's jousting with, well, tilting at windmills, and he thought they were dragons. So anyway, that's kind of a dumb analogy, but it popped into my head. So what can I tell you? It's a thrill. So I'm exhilarated and thrilled and privileged when I hear a knock or a tree push close by, when I'm sleeping out there, or when I'm just sitting out there for an hour or so, like I do these days. And the other night when I got that mimic response, I wonder if I could just play that for people.
I don't know. You can try. Do I have to share screen? Or no, you should be able to just...
I mean, it should just be the audio, right?
Should be audio. Yeah, it should just be audio.
All right. Well, keep talking. I'll find it.
Okay. And that's one of the things is, for me, you actually piqued my interest and really kind of changed a little bit of my perception, because when I had met you, I'm trying to remember the exact conversation we had, but it was more about, you had said our communication with Sasquatches maybe, and with other ones, with other beings, is psychic, but also, are we dealing with ones who are also trying to connect with us? So just like there's those of us people around that want to learn and want to connect to other beings, want to connect with other things, but then there's some of us, some people that don't want anything to do with it and don't want to connect to anything. And having those beings, those Sasquatch, that are the ones that who want to reach out, who want to further our expedition together. And then there's the ones that don't want anything to do with us, like, get away, I've got other stuff to do. So it really kind of like, I'm thinking there's multiple levels of these in different aspects, and multiple levels of those who want to connect with us.
Yeah, well, it's just like our race, you know, some of us are alert to the magnetism that is that comes from spirit, and magnetism and kinship that comes from our next of kin on Earth, which is Sasquatch. And some of us are alive to that, attuned to that, but most people aren't. You know, one of the most annoying things is when people say, "Oh, you're interested in Sasquatch? Tell me all about it. I'm fascinated by that." And then you start getting into details, like I've been today with you, and their eyes slowly glaze over because they're captivated by the idea of it, but they don't want to actually sink their teeth into the granular level of the concrete reality of it. You know, so that's why, that's part of what keeps Sasquatch safe, is that 95% of people aren't going to get out of their chairs and actually go in pursuit of learning about the species and trying to have an experience with them.
Absolutely. I think that's a great way to look at it, is, you know, there's many levels of all of us. I'm interested. I love listening to this. I love, it's like, to me, it's eye-opening. It's mind expanding. And I learn something new from every person I talk to. I'm like, oh, that's a great idea. Oh, I'm going to try that. I'm going to be working with them on that level. So for me, it's like, what next can we do? What next can we do to amplify all of these connections that we're having with so many beings on so many levels? So I think it's awesome.
Well, you're a lifelong learner. Most people just kind of learn through high school or college, and then they sort of just plateau, you know? But some of us are voraciously curious, and that's a gift. It's a lucky thing that, you know, we didn't choose to be that way. We just are that way. And then, you know, we proceed on that basis. I found the audio file. Let's see if
awesome. See if
it's audible here. Okay, so first is my silly little whoop call, and then there's 6 seconds, which is good because it shows it's not an echo, but it's soon enough that it shows it's definitely a response to me. So all right, here we go. Did you hear that?
Uh-uh.
No?
No, won't play it.
It won't play it, but it came through my audio, just like my voice comes through my audio. Oh, well.
I did hear. Oh,
okay, it was worth a try.
It was worth a try.
Oh, I have an idea. I'll send it to you. You don't have to do this. You can keep talking. I'll just send it, and if you want to, you can play it.
See if it'll play. Let's see. Yeah. See if it gets lucky. Yeah, we're playing as we go. You can still see my face, though, right?
Well, right now I'm looking at Facebook because I'm trying to send you this.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I can't figure this out. Never mind.
That's okay.
All right. So then, lots of times people report highly strange, non strictly flesh and blood episodes with Sasquatch. People will report Sasquatch speaking to them in their mind, called telepathy or mind speak. And I have a book with 20 different testimonials about people's mental relationship with their local Sasquatch, hearing things that then get borne out in physical space a day or two later, this and that, all sorts of ways in which, for me, the reports of mind speak with Sasquatch are authentic sounding, persuasive to me. I was with one of the habituators, as they're called. It's a woman in Texas, and I went to visit her 5 times over the years, and she was able to communicate with one of the females of her local group. She didn't know she could do this until one day a friend of hers on the phone, who was a real sensitive fellow, said, "You know, you can talk to her in your head." And my friend said, "Well, how would I start that?" And he said, "Well, your female's name is Suntaya. So just say her name in your mind." And so the next day, at one point, my friend felt she was ready, and she said in her mind, "Suntaya," and she heard, "What?" Like an annoyed response. And ever after that, she was able to have an open line of communication, unless Suntaya was sleeping. The whole, you know, and so when I visited, a whole bunch of things happened to prove to me that this was real. I had brought a laminated picture of my yard in Vermont, which was really lush. It was summertime, it was super lush. And I, to give to Suntaya, to show her where I live. And so then I flew down to, it's about 80 miles east of Dallas. So our first evening, my friend, the woman who lived there, and I walked down the road, and I said, now I'm going to, I had the picture underneath my shirt toward my chest so that my friend could not see it. There's no possible way she could see it unless remote viewing or something, but we're just going to put that in brackets for now.
We won't go into remote viewing this time. Okay,
that's a whole nother thing. So my friend was standing behind me, and she said, "Suntaya is across that field in those trees over there." This was sort of getting toward dusk. And so I reached in and I pulled out the paper so that the back of it was to me and to my friend, so she couldn't see it. And my friend says, "Suntaya says, 'So green, is that where you live?'" And I forgot to mention that this was during a horrible drought. 2011 in Texas, everything was brown, 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 baked, and it was 100 degrees, and it was a nightmare. And so Suntaya said, "So green." I held my picture up. A bunch of other things happened. The final thing that happened was the last day I was there, it was the morning, and I was about to drive away to go back to Dallas and fly home. And I said to my friend, I said, "Tell Suntaya that goodbye, I have to leave. And it would be great if she could make a goodbye sound for me, some sort of sound." And so so my friend kind of looked off into space, as she did when she would talk to Suntaya. And she says to wait. And so I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, it's not going to happen. Nothing's going to. And right then, like less than 10 seconds, this loud, obvious wood knock from maybe 100 feet inside the thick forest. I couldn't see anything. It was like, I can do it. Really louder than that. Just very obvious wood knock came. And at that moment, all my skepticism about mind speak just got.
Nice.
It was like a, like the knock was a bat hitting a home run. And the ball was my skepticism and it was gone.
I love that.
That metaphor works at all. I don't know. But
I think it works great because for me it's you know, there's so much I do on a telepathic level and just to have others to step into that and realize that's a real way of communicating that we all do. We do it on an everyday basis and we don't even realize it in so many aspects.
I know. It's so surprising when you are confronted with the undeniable fact that it's real. It's not just one hypothetical thing that you could sort of wonder at and, you know, have a good time daydreaming about. It's actually concretely real, just as concrete as you and I talking like this.
Absolutely.
Probably more so because this is digital.
It's digital and we're still making the communication happen.
Right.
And
telepathy is analog. It's better.
it's clearer a lot of times.
Clearer. higher fidelity. That's right. It's vinyl instead of CD. Anyway. A lot of people report telepathy and they also report other things that occur also with spirit. They'll report Sasquatch disappearing or appearing. They'll report objects being sort of coming out of nowhere, objects disappearing into nowhere. And many things that happened inside seances historically in the spiritualism movement from mid 1800s to mid 1900s was the heyday of it, but now it's making a resurgence. Seances where people will see balls of light. And in the forest, in association with seeing Sasquatch or hearing Sasquatch, people see orbs all the time. I've seen them. I saw them down in Florida, right where people also saw Sasquatch. So they're in some association with Sasquatch. I think that they're souls, consciousnesses, that can take the form of these spheres of awareness that can move around and check things out, survey the area, take the measure of a woman or a man and see what their intentions are. And it could be that Sasquatch are traveling out of their bodies like some people can do. I think that Sasquatch can more readily do perform the psychic miracles that than we can. Although, you know, some people are adept at it. I think Sasquatch as a general rule is more proficient at it than we are.
I tend to agree with you with that. I've felt for a long time is that they have been able to tap into the aspects of ourselves. Like, you know, a lot of us are, you know, exemplifying and learning the different psychic ways, the, you know, connection, moving objects, doing all things like that. But I think they've been doing it for a long time. It's more of a normal thing for them to do.
Right.
And we're just realizing it a little bit more that they can move in ways that maybe we can't yet. Not, and I should say, not all of us. Some of us have already got to that level.
Some people can, but it's a rare.
It's a rarity.
a rare egg of us that can do that. But I think our common ancestors with Sasquatch were probably adept like this, and that it's kind of gotten diluted in us down through our self-domestication. You know, the way that we're not wild anymore. We're not really connected to the earth by and large. And they are. I think they've retained the ancient capacity to for this sort of thing.
Absolutely. I also think some of it might be, and this is just my opinion, I think some of it might be our teaching. We're taught that, you know, that stuff isn't real. Don't look into it.
Well, it gets drummed out of children, doesn't it? Children Absolutely. Have imaginary friends, and sometimes they're just imaginary, and sometimes they're spirit friends, and they're real. Yeah.
That's one of the things I realize is a lot of the children's imaginary friends aren't usually so imaginary.
No, I bet they can be imaginary because there's such a thing as imagination, but I mean, lots of times, I'm sure there are actual other children from the higher vibration who managed to meet in the middle. Children being able to vibrate higher than I can, certainly, in this early stage of my spiritual development. And then their playmate counterparts can like lower their vibration a little, and they meet in the middle, and they can have a play date in the middle there.
Absolutely. And that, you know, there's so many times with I've had where they came through, and some are people that have passed that play with the children. And so, and not in a creepy way. I just want people to know that right away. Not in a creepy way, in a good right. way.
In a good, in a wholesome.
A wholesome way of keeping that connection. So there's so many on the other side that are there willing to work with us. And I really feel Sasquatch and all of the different realms there are also another being just to get to know, part of our family members, really. And it's just getting to know who they are and how to communicate with them. Because sometimes there's family members of our own we don't want to communicate with the same.
Right. Yeah. Well, one way to look at it is that our growth, our learning spiritually and consciousnessly, if I may, is just realizing how extended and extended and extended our family is. We start off by thinking of it as this nuclear family, but then it extends in all sorts of directions, like rays of light out of the nucleus or something like that. And so you certainly are embracing a wider and wider circle of family in your work and your development. And I'm trying to too. I've been focused really just on Sasquatch for the last 17 years, but just in the last little bit, I've dived into learning about spiritualism and spirit research. The scientists who have looked into this and found incontrovertible proof of the survival of consciousness after physical death, and have learned about what sort of physical manifestations are possible. And so I wrote this book called There Is No Veil, by which I mean there's no objective, essential, necessary veil. It's like a mirage.
Yeah.
It's a state of mind. And people impose it more on our side than it is in reality, because we learn, as you say, we're educated in the paradigm, the materialism paradigm, that this is all there is, what we can see and feel. And but you know, all sorts of things that obviously happen, like interacting with a dead relative, feeling the touch of somebody on the side of your head, or having an object appear out of nowhere. These things aren't there. That represents the lack of a veil. Mm. You know, like normally there's a, normally for most people, it's like there's a veil, but it's a subjective veil, not an objective veil.
I agree with you with the veil. Then that's one of the things is, like I always tell people, you know, your loved ones, they're right next to you. They're not right over here. Yeah.
They're in the same space, but the space contains more than than most people have learned to understand. The space is much more pregnant and, you know, rich, because it contains lots of different vibratory levels, and it's all different forms of matter and energy. But it's just that our senses are narrow, because we allow ourselves to funnel our experience through them rather than through consciousness itself, which transcends those senses.
Absolutely.
So in There Is No Veil, I was able to go through a lot of the history of the spiritualist movement, and just fascinating stuff that I was able to learn and write down. And I think you're looking, because I think you have some passage.
I do have a passage there. So I did go through your book, because There Is No Veil. When I saw the name of your book, I'm like, yeah, he's on the right path. because for me, I know there's no veil there. It's, we put the veil there a lot of times to protect ourselves because we kind of feel it's a little creepy to think about people right next to us or other beings right next to us, because, but we all coexist and just on different levels of consciousness, and they've always been there, but it's not being fearful of it and instead embracing it and knowing you don't have to acknowledge them 24/7. You can live your life, but when you want to, you can absolutely tap into them. So one of the things that I'm going to read a little excerpt out of here, and this was, there's a little bit more of a backstory on this, but I'll just do the basic. It says, in his autobiography, Mark Twain attests to the following incident. Recounted in a YouTube interview, The Long Self with Eric Wargo, before he was Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens was a pilot in training on a Mississippi River boat called the Pennsylvania. He got a job for his younger brother, Henry, on the same river boat. Between runs, they were staying with their older sister in St. Louis, and Samuel had a vivid dream of seeing Henry in a steel coffin wearing one of Sam's suits. He saw a woman come into the room and lay roses on the boy's chest. 3 days later, they shipped out on the Pennsylvania downriver to New Orleans, where Sam got into a fight with the boat pilot, which is probably a good thing, who foisted him ashore, so he missed the run back north. 2 days later, Sam got word that there had been a huge boiler explosion that killed, that killed many people. There is no veil, 70. He took the next available riverboat up to Memphis, where he was able to spend time with Henry as he was dying of his burns. The next morning, he entered the room where all the dead were arrayed in their pine coffins, except one. His brother had been given a steel coffin. The nurses had been so impressed with the boy's stoicism the previous night that they'd all pitched in to purchase a superior coffin. Just as Sam was standing there beholding the scene, seeing that Henry borrowed one of his suits without telling him, a nurse came in and lays a bouquet of roses on the dead boy's chest. So this is one of the excerpts you put in. I love the fact that you went back into history and you found excerpts. And this is from Samuel Clemens, which turned into Mark Twain. So why did you pick this particular story and how did you find it?
Oh, I was just watching a YouTube interview with that writer, Eric Wargo, who has a great book called Time Loops that I recommend. And he shared that story, and it was just in a section of the book that talked about precognition. So it fit in there. It was a precognitive dream that Sam Clemens had about his brother, and it came true just, what was it, 3 days later. And so it fit. That's all.
And one of the things I like is when I look through some of your books, it was bringing up, going through, you're all about taking the detail, finding the accounts, putting that stuff in there. And that's been something that a lot of people, it's dismissed, I think, a lot, because people focus on just one point or don't get to the detail. And I love the fact that when you have There Is No Veil, you went through with multiple different accounts, putting different things in there throughout the book, touching on a lot of different subjects in that book. So that's something, it kind of takes you through the story of understanding, you know, like, what do we consider the veil? How do we move through the veil? What is the veil? And why do you think the veil isn't really a veil anymore? I feel it kind of takes the reader through the whole questioning themselves.
Yeah. And I kind of like synthesizing different areas of knowledge or trying to synthesize them. So I get into physics, modern physics, relativity, the physics of information. And I sort of alternate science chapters with history of spirit research chapters and try to see the bridges between them, you know, the connective tissue. And people have found it sometimes hard to follow because I do jump to such different arenas, but that's the way I like to think. So to heck with them if they can't follow it. Some people can.
And I always look at the people who are going to be drawn to it because they're very similar to yourself, where they want to see, like, what are they saying? And then where's the scientific aspect, and kind of putting those two, bridging those two worlds together, because really I feel going forward, we're really bridging the gap of bringing that scientific aspect along with that spiritualist aspect and bringing them together, showing how they all fit together. I think that's something that's so important for people to see. And for me, I'm excited to see people getting all the foundations behind it, doing the scientific research, getting everything down, because it helps the people that are, and even myself, it helps everybody, but it really helps the people see, here's what we have, here's the evidence, here's what was said. You can kind of put it together yourself and make that assumption between you. So I really love the aspect, and I love how you put it together that way. So for me, I think it's a great way to do it. And, you know, you're talking about physics and the science aspect. And I know we touched a little bit on like quantum physics, how everything is connected. And what is your aspect on the physics of the quantum physics aspect of bringing all this together?
I don't know. Quantum mechanics is very difficult to understand, and I've just scratched the surface. Some people, I mean, one of the main concepts that people like to use when bringing it over into the spiritualism context is entanglement. You know, so if you take two photons or two electrons and you put them together and then you split them apart, they are essentially two sides of the same coin from then on. They become one object. And apparently, if you even move them a million light years apart, you're going to know which spin the other one has just by looking at the spin that this one has. And I don't know how they proved that. They've proved it on Earth. They've done experiments where, like many, many miles apart, spins, when you change one, you've simultaneously changed the other. So So I don't know, that's a very special category of experiment. So I don't know to what extent you can apply exactly that to all other kind of connectedness that happens. I think it may be like a window into the fact that distance is an illusion. And it allows us to see just absolutely mysteriously that there is no such thing as distance, because they're not communicating with each other, these two photons, because they'd have to communicate faster than the speed of light, because they change, changing one changes the other simultaneously, not quickly, but absolutely simultaneously. So that bridges the entire notion of distance. So I think that's a little aperture, a little wink into the truth that there is no such thing as real, that distance is a construct. You know, so I think that the other sort of connectedness that happens in spiritual reality is capitalizing on that fact rather than necessarily being the same entanglement phenomenon as in physics. But that's my current little sketchy understanding. It's very hard. People seem to think they know what quantum physics is. Even physicists have a hard time because it remains so counterintuitive to how we live our lives every day.
And I think quantum physics is still being explored. It's still in its infancy stage in a lot of ways. But when you touched about, you know, no time, for me, there's no time or space, distance, time, space. Yeah. That's all our own illusion. And I think these experiments are starting to show that it is just our way of managing the world versus the reality of the world.
And isn't it interesting that the spirit consciousnesses that you're in touch with will say the same thing? And then these, there's no such thing as time, sequential time or distance. You know, there's space in general, but distance, right. I mean, that's a hard distinction to draw. But it's amazing and wondrous that your spirits will tell you that. And science is discovering from increasingly many angles how concretely demonstrable and provable that is. You know, so the two, the sort of airy-fairy world of spirits is actually not foreign to or separate from the most concrete possible scientific rigorous revelations that can be made.
Sometimes I feel science is catching up with them.
Yeah. Well, no, that's what it does seem like, doesn't it? I mean, absolutely.
And it's making itself more and more known, and more people are getting more interested in it, figuring out how things operate. And I think with what you're doing, I love all the different books, all the different types of books. So you really can resonate with a lot of different type of people looking at different aspects with the veil, with Sasquatch, with all kinds of different aspects of it.
We haven't gotten into the parallels between autistic savants and Sasquatch, but we probably won't have time for that today. But if anyone's interested, I have the main book to read. It's the shortest one where I managed to boil down that hypothesis into the clearest possible terms. And it's called Sasquatch and Autism. It's a very straightforward title where I look at 12 parallels between autism, especially autistic savantism, the genius type of autistic people, and Sasquatch.
That's something that I actually had down, so I don't know if you want to cover a little bit or not, but it was, I have the Sasquatch savant theory, which is you have also the three books in one. So that was also another aspect of, you have the mind of the Sasquatch. Although we cannot yet study the psychology of the Sasquatch directly, we are in good position to already make an educated guesses about their mentality based on behavioral analysis. Skeptics are fond of asking, as though no one were remotely possible, how could an 8-foot-tall primate exist undiscovered in our backyard, meeting the issue head on? And the mind of the Sasquatch outlines the Sasquatch savant theory, revealing a personality profile of the species that differs substantially from any offered before. And Sasquatch are hardwired by evolution to conceal themselves, interacting with us only in mediated indirect fashion, and their technical genius and other striking abilities mirror the gifts seen in people known as autistic savants.
Yeah, that's about it.
They told me where to grab stuff.
who wrote that? That sounds good.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it does. Pretty clear. A little bit wordy, but yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot to that subject. It's very rich, and there's 12 different parallels that I go through. It would take half an hour to.
Absolutely. So it's definitely something maybe we could talk another time on the savants and kind of bring that in and talk about that.
Are you aware of any connection between spiritual awakeness and autism?
Yes, I've seen a lot of the autistic children who are very, mm-hmm. very connected to the other side, where when especially you'll see children where they'll be talking, they'll be doing different things, and they're having a whole conversation with others on the other side. So those connection with the autistic children to those on the other side is very, very much deeper than I think most people realize. And I'm hoping the science will start catching up with that also, because it's a treat to see the children come in and be able to interact with them and seeing and getting information from the other side, when those that I'm working with that are talking to me about what the children are experiencing, what their behaviors have been, you know, and telling the parent, this is, you know, these are the behaviors, they're saying it's because of this, or this person is interacting with them, this person is working with them, and to have that whole circle of connection. But they are so much, a lot of them, I can't speak for all of them, but a lot of them I have personally had the opportunity to work with have been very, very connected to the other side.
Yeah, I think it is true. I think there's somehow a throwback to an older way of being before we got so clouded and distracted. There's so much that Sasquatch does that autistic people do, and so much genius that Sasquatch displays in order to achieve what they achieve on a daily basis, that is quite parallel with savants, autistic savants, especially photographic memory, understanding of systems, like Sasquatch has to nail down and commit to absolutely second nature memory all of our routines and the sort of human machine going on, so that they can duck into the negative space to our positive space, or vice versa, whichever way you want to put it, and knowing better than we know what we're going to do next. And there's many other aspects to it, but that's just a little teaser.
So I encourage people to check out more of Christopher's information, his books, his YouTube channel, go on his Facebook, and go on Amazon. If you look up his name, again, that link will be down below.
I have a website too, which is thenearnessofyou.net.
I will add that on here on the bottom.
Thank you.
Nearnessofyou.net.
Thenearnessofyou.net.
And that one will be, all the links will be down below. So definitely check on that. But there's so much information you've been covering in all different realms. And that's one of the things I found so interesting with you, is you're not just pigeonholed on one aspect, but instead you're taking that and just expanding and expanding and expanding what you're learning, what you're discovering. And I love all the information you're putting behind it. So people are looking like, where's the evidence? What do I look at? Where do I look? And you're putting it on there. And I think that's so important for so many people.
Well, thank you. I've been kind of in fear of spreading myself too thin. That's why I just focused on Sasquatch and not other paranormal topics. But then I just recently sort of circled back to the spiritual thing, because I had this months-long conversation with a ghost when I was 17, and always meant to circle back and learn more about what the heck was going on there. And now I'm going to also have to include UFOs because of all the revelations that are coming out lately. Oh my gosh, I can't be in my comfortable little, my cozy little Sasquatch circle exclusively anymore, but that's okay. It's all about expanding and learning. I forgot to say one thing that I was going to say, which is I came up with the title, There Is No Veil, when I was in a Dollar General store buying some cat food and some wine. I thought, I had written a bunch of the book and researched a bunch, and I thought, what should I call this book? And that title flittered into my mind, flittered in. And then when I got in the car outside and I was just about to leave the parking lot and enter traffic, I heard a very obvious, loud, metallic raps on my back passenger window. Like it was as if somebody had a quarter and were going, rep, 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 high pitched metallic glass on metal, like five of them. Bup, 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 bup. And I turned, there's nobody there, nothing there. And I took that as a sort of a thumbs up, an endorsement, because there's no veil between that window and whatever was hitting it. I'll tell you that much. It's very loud and obvious. And that sort of thing doesn't happen to me much. A lot of people have that kind of stuff happen all the time, but this was surprising and very very uplifting.
So, I think the other really nice thing with that is you're showing, like you said, you don't usually have that type of thing happen to you. Show people, once you start opening yourself up, once you start being aware of the possibilities, how they're more than willing to come through and start doing, having some fun.
It was thinking of that title. I mean, maybe they gave me that title. Obviously that's possible, but just to sort of taking that next little baby step beyond being stuck in that paradigm of thinking there's a big separation between dimensions, allowed the dimensions to inflate right then on my window. It's a pretty remarkable thing. I was so happy.
That's the thing I love with you're taking an aspect where you didn't really fully maybe believe they could do it. You had hope, but didn't think, you know, didn't know if they could. And then it's happening and you're documenting it. And that's the thing. A lot of things happen. A lot of people don't document it. They don't have it down. So and that's the biggest thing with you, is you're documenting everything.
I'm kind of like a journalist. I feel driven to nail things down and to preserve them for whatever, for posterity or for know, I may never get to see the discovery, the scientific acceptance, and the mainstream acceptance of the Sasquatch species. But once it is accepted, I hope that my contribution will still resonate with to some extent. You know, so that's what motivates me. It's a good sort of vision to have.
It's funny you brought that up, that you wanted to be a part of that, and earlier we talked about how there really is no time and space. It's timeless. So anything we do now, it's timeless and will be resonating with someone at some point.
Whoa. But there, for most of the human race, they're still going to experience things in sequential, that even if it's an illusion, that's the, how it'll unfold for them. So somebody reading my books 100 years from now, for them, it will be 100 years, even if in true truth, it won't be. Anyway.
But even at that point, there some people will just be more waking up, as we call it sometimes, of just discovering it. And they're going to discover it at the exact time they're ready for it.
Yeah, that'll be good. And I was ready for it when I had that thing happen with the window. But I guess I wasn't ready. I needed 17 years to study Sasquatch. And then I could move that into a wider field of vision. And so chapter 13 in There Is No Veil is just about Sasquatch and these strange things that happen with that species that we've witnessed are very much in keeping with typical events and episodes that have been documented in seances and in with physical mediums, people who, around whom the malleability of matter is constantly demonstrated. So I was able to put Sasquatch in that broader context. And so now it was time finally to increase my embrace, try to increase the embrace. You know, that's what we're trying to do here, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. Bringing everything together and showing that everything really does fit together. It's not such a separate thing. It's not one thing or the other. But instead, it's a culmination of all of it and seeing how it all fits. I always like to, it's like, how do the puzzle pieces fit together? So for me, it's always like, what part of the puzzle is this and where does it go? And does it fit there completely or does it kind of morph around? So right. It's always right. Fun to see how it fits together.
It's really the childlike wonder that we try to maintain.
Absolutely. And
I've always felt like a child at heart. And I always have felt kind of discouraged by the sort of stodginess of most adults.
And that's the thing is to keep, like for me, I know I'm going to be learning right up to the day I die. I'm excited for that. You know, I'm dying in the physical. I'll keep going on. So yeah,
then your learning will really accelerate after that.
But it's more of being excited for what you can learn next. What can you discover next about yourself, about the world around you? And that's really where we need to be.
Amen, and sister.
And that's what you're helping so many people with, your books, with everything you've got. So I think we'll have to start closing pretty soon. I just wanted to thank you so much for being here, and I wanted to encourage people, so check out his Facebook page at christopher.noel.980, his the nearness of you.net, his website, and the Impossible Visits YouTube channel, and also his information for his books is on Amazon. You can check out, you can look up. I looked on Amazon there. You have a lot of books on there, and I found it's better to look by your name, and then it lists all the books you have. So there's so much great information out there. I hope all of you take the time to check into that because it's well worth it. And There Is No Veil, playing in the vast here now, is going to be, it's a very interesting and mind-altering book as far as altering your perceptions. So I think the perceptions that we all have about the veil, and when I saw the cover, There Is No Veil, I'm like, yep, somebody gets it. There is no veil.
Finally, somebody.
I love it.
Well, I appreciate this conversation that we've had, and I'm very, very humbled by your recommendation to everybody that they pursue my books and my videos and everything. And you're contributing greatly in your own niche, which is a large one. So we overlap and we also do our own thing. So it's a pleasure to cross-pollinate with you.
Awesome. And same here. It's been a pleasure. And thank you so much for the comments or the compliments. I appreciate it. And I love what I do. And I love bringing more people like you to expose you to other people, to different groups of people. I think it's so important that all of us are working together, making a whole new community and opening ourselves up and opening other people up to other options and opportunities that are out there. And I am so excited to have you on here. And I just wanted to thank you again so much for being on here. And I hope all of you enjoyed your conversation with Christopher Noel. It has been amazing. I have had a great time. And I want to thank all of you for listening today. I appreciate all of you. And I hope all of you have an absolutely amazing day.